I'd like to thank the speakers for all their time and effort and prayers they presented. We're running a little bit behind, so we have time for one or two questions, and I'm sorry that we don't have more time for that. Go ahead.
Thank you for a vibrant session. I have a couple questions. First question is for Dr. Chaudhary. Many times these patients that get transplants, they end up clotting off their existing access. What is your thoughts on declotting these patients at that time? It's a very common consult I get.
Can you hear me? So that's a fair point. And I'm going to wear my transplant hat over here. You know, I think if you, in particular, if you've got a kidney that's functioning well, I would just go and I would go with the kidney and not declot. So that's my personal view. I think in many cases you know if you get somebody who's got a creatinine of 3 and the transplant has been functioning for 5 years but is now not doing so well and the thrombosis has occurred at that time, then I think it's very different. Then I would see whether you could declot it. But in general, the thromboses actually tend to occur, again, anecdotally, early on. And at that time, if you've got a creatinine of 0.8 or 1.2, I would just let the fistula go.
Thank you. And then the second question for the panel is, not sure I agree with the thinking of anticoagulating that patient with the IJ. Claude, I wanted to get the panel's opinion on that, as well as placement of the catheters in these brachiocephalic and subclavian veins?
I don't think anybody has a definite answer, and I think people use different... You should be here then. Come over.
That's right.
So there's a very clear answer on that. In the journal CHEST, the critical care guys have written very good standards for treatment of DVT. DVT of all body parts. In fact, the document is about 80 pages long, and Section 8 has to do with upper extremity DVT and catheter-related DVT, and you do not anticoagulate them if they're not symptomatic. You do not. So you are correct. You do not anticoagulate asymptomatic patients.
We can't let Dr. Wesley go. Tim.
Dr. Paulson, you made a very nice case that using flow measurements in isolation doesn't predict access survival and may not even accurately predict thrombosis. The problem I have with that conclusion is extrapolating it beyond isolation. And I would no sooner tell my dialysis staff not to measure an access flow then I would tell them not to examine the graft or the fistula. And I think the point is that when we combine data as we monitor these accesses function, when we examine them, when we look at the KT over V, whether there are cannulation difficulty, whether there's prolonged bleeding, and access flows, when we use that data in combination, it's a critical part of our monitoring and maintenance of the access. And I don't hear that talked about much. I just hear the criticism of isolated access flows. Can you give your thoughts about that?
Is this working? I agree with what you say. I'm perfectly willing to have a blood flow measurement on my patient. In fact, my dialysis unit measures blood flow once a month in everybody. The problem is, as you say, in isolation. If you look at the KDOQI guidelines, they say that, for example, if the blood flow falls by 25% and it's less than 1,000, refer the patient. And I would be willing to bet that most nephrologists don't apply this whole patient approach that you do. If I do see something that's going on with the flow, what I would do is I would remeasure it, and I would certainly try to get something to correlate with it. I think the biggest problem is that flow surveillance it will not work unless you've got a lot of measurements, and that's not practical with flow measurements. But I agree with what you say.
Dr. Esch.
Just another comment about the normalization of flow to arterial pressure. Last year, Dr. Demija and and Henschel and I published that you can actually measure the static inter-axis peak pressure very easily. In fact, just by measuring how far the air-blood interface bounces into a needle in a, during a dry stick. But nobody would think that an inter-axis pressure makes any sense without normalizing by the systemic pressure. So do you think that if you're going to do a flow measurement, you should normalize by the systemic pressure? And if so, does that, would that make it a more predictive measure of stenosis?
Are you, well, you mentioned pressures, but are you talking about flow again?
Yeah, flow. Yeah. So in other words, if we're going to continue doing flow, why don't we normalize it by what the mean arterial pressure is every time we measure it?
Well, actually, that ends up being a little bit more complicated than it seems, because the implication would be that, that there's a linear relationship between pressure and flow, and it turns out with all the variables that are going on, that it's probably not. But that is one way of looking at it. I think, though, that regardless of the pressure, if the blood flow is low and you try to adjust for the fact that the blood pressure was low, then you may end up with a misleading measurement. The whole point being that regardless of the blood pressure, if the blood flow is low, the axis may clot. So I think it's something that people have looked at, and we did actually a poster at a meeting on this some time ago, and it was our conclusion that it was more complicated than it sounds. I do think, though, that it does work for venous pressure surveillance, that there is a linear relationship between the venous pressure and the systemic pressure. That's a whole other ballgame. I'll just say that I think venous pressure is probably more viable than blood flow, because it's easy to get a lot of venous pressure measurements, and there are even some commercially available methods of getting several venous pressure measurements per session and thereby detect a change in hemodynamics before you clot the axis. But there's no randomized controlled trials.
Right. It would just seem to me that perhaps, certainly any future trials, should get rid of this major variable in the change of flow, which is the change in pressure. So.
Yeah.
For the sake of time, we're going to take one short question and hopefully one shorter answer.
My question is to Prabir. The patient with a failing transplant generally maintains urinary output. And you mentioned, unfortunately, that 70% start with a return to dialysis using that central venous catheter. You forgot to mention the good catheter, PD. It seems ideal in this setting because you could embed it in when the patient looks like they're failing and going to need to return to dialysis, and then bring it out when they need to start back with PD. Okay, comments? Why aren't we doing this more frequently?
No, I agree 100%. I mean, I said at the beginning I was really going to focus on more about the process of care and the fact that this discussion needs to be done about the type of access in a transplant patient before. And it could be a fistula and it could be PD. And in general, I believe at least that all the things we've discussed in terms of different types of access in the general population is also completely applicable to the transplant. I agree also 100%. It's a great, because of the interactions with the transplant, with surgeons who often put catheters in, that it's a very, very good option. Thank you.